As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Let's get to the nuance right now in the equity markets. I'm with Mike Wilson, Morgan Stanley's Chief U.S. Equity Strategist and CIO. Mike, great to catch up with you as always, sir. And let's start with margins. Been a big thing for us this morning. A lot of people think that maybe this margin story, which has held up in corporate America, that story can persist into a new year. Do you think it can?
Well, look, I mean, I think margins have surprised on the upside. That was really the call last year, which always happens, as you know, coming out of a recession, you get operating leverage. This time it was extraordinary because you had policy support that essentially subsidized the unemployment that was out there, right? People were home, but they were still getting checks from the government and they could spend it digitally. So that is unique. And we see that being a problem going forward where people have made assumptions now that those extraordinary margins are going to be carried forward. We see a couple areas in particular, consumer discretionary, industrials, parts of the technology market look to be a little bit lofty in terms of margin expectations. That's where we are in the cycle. We see no reason why it's going to be any different. And because it was so acute on the upside with operating leverage on the upside, it's not going to be a surprise to us if we see a little bit more margin degradation as we go into 2022. And that needs to get baked into people's expectations.
Mike, your great strength as a sell-side analyst at Morgan Stanley. I know you and I are all Jack Welch 101 on pricing power. Sector to sector, analyst to analyst, what does your team say about the ability of corporations to adapt and generate pricing power?
Yeah, it's the key question. I mean, there's going to be companies that absolutely have pricing power. We've been, you know, looking for those types of companies in our recommendations going forward. You know, one thing we've noticed, Tom, as you know, I mean, the market's gotten very narrow. Obviously, we've seen companies, higher quality companies and larger cap companies who have scale. The market is paying up for those now because those are the types of companies that typically have pricing power. Okay, so I mean, that's the name of the game. It's like costs are going up for everyone. So two areas I think you can look to say maybe they'll be protected. Companies that don't have as big of a labor component, we do think labor is going to be an issue not just for the economy, but for the Fed ultimately, that they're going to have to tap down there. And that's that's going to be, you know, so technology companies is an example where they don't have as much labor. They can maybe manage through that. And of course, scale always gives you the ability to kind of spread costs across a bigger slate of revenue.
So Mike, does this mean tech continues to outperform and other types of sectors, the ones that lead the move lower, where you see the S&P ending the year below where we are now?
No, I think technology has gotten a double boost here, Lisa. I mean, it's obvious candidate for, you know, pricing power or the ability to kind of manage costs. But it also is probably the single biggest beneficiary of this incredibly move lower in rates at the back end, which doesn't really jibe with what's going on in the real economy. We know why that's happening. The Fed has been ultra slow, ultra dovish to kind of get off the maximum accommodation mode. And so that's been baked in now. So as rates move higher, which is our call for the rest of this year, you know, the valuation on some of these long duration tech stocks will offset their ability to generate the earnings growth that's been spectacular.
Mike, what does that mean for your index level call going into year end? Because you have looked for that index level correction as we work our way through this mid-cycle transition. Where are we now, Mike?
So we're working through that mid-cycle transition. We're seeing corrections kind of happen around the market, but not at the index level, which is typical too, John. You know, and then it usually ends with an index level correction when the market can't find anywhere else to go where there's value. So we think we're kind of in the, I don't know, sixth inning We probably have 3 or 4 months left to go for this mid-cycle transition. Usually it ends with the Fed finally moving forward with either a tightening like it did in 94 or in 04 or some form of tapering or balance sheet running off like it did in 2011. And we think it's no different this time. By the way, that's not a crazy statement. I mean, is there anybody on the planet who doesn't think the Fed's going to be tapering next year? No.
Well,
in fact, if they're not tapering, then we got a serious problem.
Well,
so the mid-cycle transition will end with multiples coming down at the index level because the Fed is tightening policy. It's that simple.
Mike, a lot of people expect the Fed to tighten policy. And as you said, if they don't, that may become more of a problem. You said that the 1.8% year-end target for the 10-year note actually could be conservative because the Fed is so behind the curve and may be forced to raise rates faster than expected. Play out what that would look like and when we would know that perhaps rates should rise more. And that would be later this year, right?
It could be sooner than later this year. It could be next month. You know, I mean, let's see how the Fed wants to communicate this path. I mean, maybe it starts at Jackson Hole. Maybe it starts in September, which is our bet that they start to communicate when they're going to do this. And, you know, but the other way to think about it, at least, is the bond market, you know, is not stagnant. The bond market will start to challenge the Fed in their timing of that communication if it believes they're falling too far behind the curve. Right. I mean, We're basically close to full employment now based on, you know, the wage increases that we're seeing and the commentary we're hearing from companies. Like, we don't really know what NARU is. Maybe it's 4%, maybe it's 4.5%, maybe it's 5%. We don't really know. What we do know is that labor supply has probably been impaired during the pandemic, maybe permanently, we'll find out. And, you know, typically the Fed is tightening policy long before we get to NARU. They start the process. You know, once again, I don't think anybody would disagree with this statement, which is, does it seem right that we have emergency monetary accommodation at a time when the economy is growing 6.5% real, 8.5%, 9% nominally? That doesn't seem like it jibes. And I think the Delta variant is the market is saying, okay, well, let's see how the Delta variant plays out. But if we find that the Delta variant is fading, schools are reopening, we are going to get back to work, you know, the bond market can adjust quickly.
Yeah.
Very much like we saw in January and February, the last time that we were kind of out of consensus on the rate moves. You know, probably surprising on the upside.
Such a good final point, Mike. We've got to leave it there. It's good to catch up, sir. Michael Wilson, Morgan Stanley, Chief U.S. Equity Strategist and CIO.
A decade ago, or even more, I should say, I learned about field economics from Pascaline Dupas. Her colleague is Esther Duflo, who won the Nobel Prize with Banerjee. Banerjee and Duflo have become definitive on poverty economics. The new effort out is Good Economics for Hard Times, out in paperback today. And Esther, congratulations again, not only on the acclaim you've received, but the persistency that you've worked with in studying poverty. And part of that is in one of the chapters of your book, The End of Growth. Give us the optimism that growth is not ended.
Oh, I don't know if I can give you the optimism. I think it depends if you have a glass half full or a glass half empty type of person, because the truth is we don't know. We have no idea. Growth does whatever it wants to do. Economists have found it very difficult to predict how to nurture it. We know very well how to kill it. Venezuela is a good case study on how to kill growth. But once the basic conditions are there, we don't really know how to nurture it. So that's the bad news. But the good news also means that it also comes and goes, and policymakers and economists can do a lot of things to make sure that once it's there, everyone in the economy, including the poor, take maximum advantage of it.
I look at the idea of growth and poverty, and of course the foundation of this is Robert Solow at your MIT and the study of growth over the years. And the elephant in the room is technology and its advantages. Can we process technology over to relieve poverty, or is the benefits of technology the benefits of the elite?
Well, another thing Bob Solow told us, he was really one of the giants of the field, is that technology is really the measure of our ignorance. What he called technology is basically what we're not very good at measuring. And for the same reasons, we don't know whether it helps or hurts, but it depends a little bit on what we are doing. For example, If we have new machines that replace workers, it happened during the Industrial Revolution, it's happening again today with automation, with AI. There is no big law of economics that says that these workers will necessarily find another job, and there is no big law of economics that says that they won't. The truth is that it depends on whether they are helped, whether they are accompanied, whether they are trained in the new technology to find new jobs. So there is a massive role for policy and for policymaking to accompany the process of the diffusion of technology throughout our economies and to make it a force for good as opposed as a force for destruction.
And a perfect example, frankly, is a technology that we've seen deployed for the mRNA inoculations that have at least helped stave off some of the progress of the COVID-19 virus. One thing I find fascinating is that your book, which was first published in November 2019, focused intensely on the need to get vaccines across the world to prevent certain diseases. Why has there not been more money and more of a coordinated effort to create a network of vaccinations globally, well before this pandemic?
Well, what is really sad in a way is that to some extent this network does exist. There is a very successful international initiative called Gavi that has been quite effective at promoting the spread of immunization around the world before the COVID-19 pandemic. That's childhood immunization. And there has been a lot of progress in the decade starting 2019 in childhood immunization. And we haven't found a more effective or cost-effective way to save lives than childhood immunization. So when the COVID-19 pandemic came, and thanks to technology and wonderful research ingenuity and a lot of effort and government funding, we had a vaccine so quickly. This network was pre-existing, but somehow, to this date, we haven't been able to mobilize it with the goal in mind to immunize the entire world against COVID. And this is really sad because, in a sense, it was there. It really wasn't going to take much more than money and single-minded focus on the entire world and not just on the US or on Europe. Mm-hmm.
Professor Duflo, thank you so much. Greatly, greatly appreciate this morning in celebration of her new effort with Professor Banerjee as well.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Right now, a joy. Marilyn Watson joins us with BlackRock, head of global fundamental fixed income strategy, her public service to the United Kingdom, working at the Bank of England, noted. Marilyn, I look at the bond market right now, and it's a jumble in fiscal stimulus in the United States. Is the fiscal stimulus in the United States a global phenomenon, or is it discrete to the United States?
So I think that the fiscal stimulus that we saw before certainly was a global phenomenon, and it certainly did help to promote growth globally, even though we did see these issues, obviously, with the pandemic and supply chain issues and global mobility really being restricted. I think going forward, when we do see the new package coming through, it will be largely very pertinent to the US, particularly when you look at the focus on infrastructure and on things that are very domestic to the US. That withstanding, I do think it was going to still have a significant impact globally as well when you look at the demand that you might have for for commodities from abroad, when you look at the demand for various things that will feed into the different packages. I do think it will have some impact globally, but this time around, I think it will be more pertinent to the US.
How big will the impact be on the bond market, Marilyn? Tens right now at 133.
Yeah, so the market, I think, is already pricing it in to a large degree. I think at the moment, I mean, when you look at the bond market, it really is very difficult to really understand why yields are still down at this level. And I heard, your previous speakers and you saying that, we do think the tens will, rise further throughout this year. I think at the moment, you know, the market is still digesting some negative news around COVID. And also we're still continuing to see this huge amount of suppression coming from the central banks. As you do start to get more from the FOMC, as they do start to taper, start to withdraw this very, very, very accommodative monetary policy, I think that will help to shift yields higher. And then I also think that, you know, you are seeing in the equity market, you're seeing in the bond market as well, already you're pricing in the stimulus that you're going to come through from the fiscal as well.
Are we starting to discriminate within credit, Marilyn, given what's happened with the Delta variant in this country? I'm thinking of the likes of Carnival and others in the credit market. Are we starting to discriminate a little bit more?
I think that's right. So obviously at the beginning of the pandemic, you did see quite a large amount of dispersion and discrimination between the different names. I think now, again, where you see that spreads are still incredibly tight, really across the board, across all sectors. When you look at the huge amount of crowding that we have in different asset classes and sectors of the bond market, because again, the monetary policy stimulus is really pushing investors down the risk spectrum. Now, I think, is the time where we really are starting to see a lot more from a bottom-up perspective. And I think it's important as you start to look where to invest in the bond market at these incredibly tight spreads and you know, pretty rich valuations in general. Then I think, you know, it's really, really, really important that you really understand from a bottom-up perspective exactly the dynamics behind that company, behind the sector, and you really have a very, very high conviction in the bonds that you're buying. And I think we are starting to see that, and I think we'll see that further going forward, and it's incredibly important now.
Marilyn, a lot of people have said that the credit cycle is dead. What you are saying is that it is not, and that is why it is so important to do bottom-up research. What does this credit cycle look like, given where we are with Treasury yields and given where we are with the balance sheets of corporate America that are pretty good?
Yeah, they do look pretty good. And, you know, I think there are quite a few positives when you look at, as you say, the balance sheets of some of these corporates. When you think that even when the Fed does start to reduce, you know, its accommodative monetary policy, it's still going to be incredibly supportive for a very long time. And as the economy continues to do well, we're seeing this huge amount of demand. And you spoke earlier about, you know, the demand supply, you know, imbalance that still will take some time to correct. I think we're going to continue to see a lot more demand going forward. And this is going to bode, I think, very well, particularly for those companies that have already being investing, that are going to be investing in, you know, in technology, communications. They're going to be improving their supply chains. And I think that those companies will do well as we see growth continue to, you know, carry on at this very, very robust pace that we're seeing.
All right, Marilyn, what's more important for an investor? Clipping coupons on a company that looks like it has a promising trajectory, even if that coupon is a lot lower, or searching for some sort of growth story at a time when the economy does seem to be expanding and when the consumer does have a lot of money to spend?
Well, I actually think that you need a balance of both. It's very hard at the moment to, you really have to do a lot of bottom-up research to find those companies where you are going to see the significant growth and you can really capture the price appreciation, so to speak. I also think it's important to find, you know, in the bond market, areas of carry where you can get that steady income that you need. And it also depends on the investor. So we've seen, you know, the huge continuing amount of demand, even for treasuries, from pension funds that have very, very good funding statuses, from investors from abroad. You're continuing to see investors, corporate investors, investing in, you know, corporate bonds, even high yield, where they're looking for a little bit more carry to match their liabilities. So I think both are important, but I think really understanding the liquidity of those positions, understanding the risk-reward dynamic, understanding the potential volatility are all very important. And I actually think a very well-constructed, balanced portfolio is the most important thing now.
Marilyn, thank you. It's good to catch up as always. Marilyn Watson, there, BlackRock head of Global Fundamental Fixed Income Strategy.
The research report is so important for Doug Kass, Paul Sweeney, that we got to get right to it. But Paul, have you noticed like Brett Gardner just endures?
Every time I hear somebody say we need to trade him or cut him, I'm like, you crazy. If for no other reason, then he shows up every day. There's no oblique tears. I know everybody hits 200, but he's there every day.
Doug Kass joins us to further the conversation now with Seabreeze Partners. Brett Gardner, would you trade him, Doug?
So much to say about the markets and the Red Sox, but so little time. All I could say is the last time I appeared, Paul, with you and Tom, the odds makers I mentioned had the Yankees at a 4% odds of making the playoffs.
Yeah.
As I said on the show, I made that bet. Now the odds are close to 50%.
All right.
Tampa Bay, Toronto, and the Yankees have each won 8 of the last 10 ball games.
There you go.
The Red Sox have lost 8 of the last 10. It's August for the Red Sox. I say res ipsa loquitur.
Yeah, it's the August of my many childhoods as well. Doug, let's move on to the markets in an important research note from you yesterday with a single sentence: sell stocks. Why?
Right. Well, I would distill my current view by twisting around a quote from a student of Bob Farrell, Walt Diemer. Now, Wally, like Bob, is a legendary technical analyst who worked at Putnam when I was there. And Wally used to say, when the time comes to buy, you won't want to. So I say now, twisting around his quote, when the time comes to sell or short, you won't want to either. I think we're in a well-defined tug of war. On one hand, we have a quickening federal debt spiral that is now out of control. The rate of domestic economic growth is decelerating. We have a marked slowdown in China, which has been the engine of global growth over the last 20 years. The Federal Reserve is likely to soon pivot. Inflation and inflationary expectations are climbing. Cost pressures are intensifying. There's an acceleration in the spread of Delta variant, and the individual and corporate tax rates are moving higher. Moreover, and this is really important, I touched on it last time, a lot of demand has been pulled forward, as we learned in the quarterly releases at Apple, Amazon, Pinterest, Facebook, Netflix, and many others. And that pull forward is now ending as people begin to normalize their lives. I think to make matters worse, historic valuations based upon all traditional metrics are mostly at all-time highs. In fact, I have 15 metrics on the S&P's valuation, and three-quarters of them are at the 100% historic percentile. Now, we have to be balanced. And on the other hand, the positives are also pretty clear. The offset to my concerns is obviously something you touched on in the last segment, the tailwind of liquidity. Last time I was with you and Paul, I stated that if we graph the Fed's balance sheet with the S&P index, it's a perfect fit. It's a high R-squared, or coefficient of determination. And for the CFAs out there, I know you referenced the failing rate of CFAs over the last 12 months. R-squared is basically the proportion of the variation in a dependent variable.
This is like a seminar from an independent variable,
Schiller course. So for some time, it's been clear to end this modern and undisciplined fiscal and monetary policy, coupled with the market structure, have been the primary determinants of market support. And it could be argued today that investors are the least informed and least educated because they're all...
Oh, listen to you now. Here we go.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean that was like a dissertation from Kidder Peabody a few years ago.
No. Look. I'm ripping up the script, to use your phrase.
As I say, yep.
Unlike a lot of very confident guests parading in the media, I don't have all the answers. I'm often wrong. I'm always in doubt. And I recognize that the market will do the best to twist around the consensus. I remember Grandma Koufax used to tell me, always look over my shoulder because the Cossacks might be coming. So when I question my investment sanity, as I do today, I go to people like Lee Cooperman and Howard Marks, and I give them a call. And arguably the best go-to guy, the greatest investment hitter of all time, to use a baseball metaphor, are Ruth, Gehrig, and Williams combined, is Stan the Man. And I don't mean Stan Musial. Mm-hmm. I mean Stan Druckenmiller. And just to conclude, if your listeners go to YouTube and search USC Marshall School of Business speech that Stanley
just gave,
he outlines the unusual state. And highly recommend it. It runs only 25 minutes. It's available for free.
Let's let Paul
and it discusses the uniqueness of this time in our economy.
We got to get Paul in here. This is not a monologue, Mr. Cass.
Doug, I'm sorry. Your note, and a lot of the items that you just noted went through in terms of the challenges for this market. Some of them have been there for a while. Do you have a catalyst in mind that you think will kind of bring these to the fore for the marketplace?
That's the best question ever, because every night it keeps me awake. You know, what is going to make me – I relaunched Seabreeze Partners, my hedge fund, on July 1st. I was absent in the hedge fund business for 8 years after recovering from cancer. And I have been slightly net short since then for the last 5 weeks. And we're actually in the black, which is a good accomplishment. To me, the single most important factor will be a sustained level of the 10-year yield in excess of 1.3%, and I think we're moving in that direction.
So the issue here is, I think the market probably, Doug, is saying, okay, we understand tapering is coming. We understand that rates are likely going up, certainly, you know, let's call it 2023 perhaps, but we have faith in this Fed. And that seems to be what we hear. Is that faith not enough?
It's not enough. You know, Webster defines a Ponzi scheme as an investment swindle in which some early investors are paid off with money put up by latter ones in order to encourage more and more risks, bigger risks. And our economic policy, Paul, is beginning to look that way. We have massive government spending. It's benefiting current citizens and being financed by taking enormous amounts of debt, which will burden our future citizens. As a result, we live in a world where economic health is a bit of an artificially created illusion. Yeah. And both the market, the stock market, and the bond market have soared as a result. The question is whether, as you put it, this is sustainable and what are the consequences if it is not. So in a sense, I think, Tom and Paul, and I'm not being hyperbolic, we could be witnessing the biggest Ponzi scheme in history. So the risk, especially at current valuations, is extraordinary. And it seems to me that with a substantial recovery underway, the Fed should immediately begin to reduce its artificial support, which has so distorted the economy and our markets.
Doug Kass, quickly here, on Amazon, you've got a short-term view, you've got a bullish long-term view. Doug Kass on Amazon.
I'm a buyer, $32.50 after having sold it right before the disappointing second quarter release. The stock immediately fell $330 in the next day. Again, that was an example, as I referenced, of pulling forward demand. I think the stock will trade in a pretty narrow range, and I would be a buyer at that level.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
We wanted to get a breath of fresh air always with AGF Investments' Greg Valliere on our political system. Greg, I am so fed up with the cluelessness that all senators are the same. I consider the senator from Vermont winning 67% of the vote in his last go around. And I look at Tina Smith in Minneapolis, who we featured earlier, in Minnesota, who I think was winning with 48% or something like that. I mean, there's a lot of people like the senator from Minnesota right now that have to step very carefully in these two proposals.
Absolutely, Todd. This first one we'll get in a few hours. We all know that. But I am not euphoric that this somehow means we've got this done. The really heavy lifting now comes on the second bill, which would have $3.5 trillion in spending and new taxes. That's crazy. It's never going to happen. And people like Tina Smith know it. And at some point, they're going to have to give this bill a very big haircut.
Is it a new deal? I mean, I get the politics and I get the symbolism, but Greg, you're expert on the breadth of history of our politics. Is it a Biden new deal?
Yes, it is, to a large extent. It's the biggest New Deal type of spending since FDR. If we got what they proposed yesterday, and I would argue that $3.5 trillion could quickly go down to 2.5, maybe to 2, maybe even below that. Wow. I think we'll get a bill, but there are some big, big obstacles. The debt ceiling, the fact that a smaller price tag would infuriate the progressives like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who has votes that she could put into this fight. So the fall is going to be a ferocious fight. And just because we get a deal today does not portend that we're going to get a deal in 2 months.
Greg, how far can the $550 billion bipartisan infrastructure bill go without something more concrete on this other reconciliation package?
That's a great question, Lisa. And I think that if we don't get the second part saying we're going to use reconciliation, that's the big Schumer goal, where you won't have to have a big veto fight. Yeah, that'll get us into the fall. But once we do get into the fall, the price tags are going to be huge. And there looks like, at least for now, a very intractable battle over raising the debt ceiling that's going to complicate everything.
Well, the reason why I ask is because a lot of people are treating the bipartisan plan as a sure thing. It basically has a lot of support on all sides, and yet it does seem to be linked in sort of an unknowable way to this other proposal that seems like pie in the sky, according to almost all accounts. So there is a question of what is the willingness of Democrats to torpedo the bipartisan effort in order to push forward something on the other side?
Well, there is a willingness. If you talk to people like Joe Manchin or Kristen Sinema of Arizona, that they would never agree to tax increases of this magnitude. If I'm not mistaken, we have an election coming up next year, and the idea that we're going to raise taxes this dramatically, I think, would be suicidal on the part of the Democrats.
Meanwhile, inflation very much in the forefront of people's minds. We got a survey yesterday out of the Federal Reserve showing that consumers' expectations for inflation over the next couple of years are rising to the highest level since at least 2013. How does that play in some of these spending debates?
Well, it's a factor. And the Republicans are arguing, I think somewhat disingenuously, that this spending will cause inflation. A lot of commodities, as you guys know, have dropped in the last few weeks, oil, copper, lumber. You know, we do have a wage problem. I think that's more intractable, obviously. But the Republicans will play this up. They've got some big issues: immigration, inflation, and in my opinion, especially crime.
Who are you watching in the Republican Party? I mean, away from former President Trump, who does Greg Valliere watch in Washington?
Well, for weeks and weeks and weeks, everyone said DeSantis, and his halo has slipped in Florida, no question. So the new hot name right now is an African-American Republican from South Carolina, Tim Scott. A very well-spoken, not way, way out on the right, a likable guy. He may run for president, and he's raising a lot of money.
Greg? Go on, Tom.
No, I'm sorry. My brain was just going there and raising money. We can talk to Valliere for hours.
On,
I'm sorry,
on.
John.
No, you can get a final one in.
Can I get one
something?
In?
Absolutely. Go on.
Raising money is a huge deal. Explain to our audience, Greg Valliere, why raising money is the heart of the matter.
Oh, you got to have ads on TV. And if you want to have ads on TV, you've got to raise a ton of money. We're already seeing saturation ads here in D.C. for the Virginia gubernatorial race.
There you
which
go.
It's still 2.5 months away.
John, is it like that in the United Kingdom? Does Boris Johnson have to raise a lot of money?
No, things are a little bit more straightforward in the UK, Tom.
God,
we talk about this every cycle, don't we?
I know, but I just wish we'd get there.
I know which one you'd prefer.
Yeah.
We get it done in a
ridiculous
shorter time frame.
Yeah,
Greg, thank you. We can go
that
now.
That's fabulous.
Greg Valliere, AGF Investments, right. Chief U.S. Policy Strategist.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.